This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Mario Vargas Llosa with Efren Cristal, recorded in Santa Fe on April 5th, 2006. Peruvian-born Mario Vargas Llosa is internationally recognized for his culturally and politically charged novels. He has said, quote, "I think literature is impoverished if it becomes cut from the main agenda of people, of society, of life," end quote. After reading from his work, Vargas Llosa joins in conversation with Efren Cristal, a professor of Spanish and comparative literature and a specialist in Vargas Llosa's work.
Good evening. My name is Efren Cristal, and I'm a literature professor at UCLA. And before I begin with my formal introduction, I would like to congratulate Mr. Vargas Llosa on the 30th anniversary of the publication of Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, but also on the 70th anniversary of his birth, which was celebrated only a few days ago. I would also like to make a little historical point, because hundreds of years ago, Mr. Vargas Llosa's ancestors moved from northern Spain to the New World. Had all of them settled in New Mexico, like Don Diego de Vargas, today we would be welcoming a native son. Now, instead, we are welcoming the descendant of the Vargas cousin from the great Peruvian city of Arequipa. Throughout his long career as a writer and public intellectual, Mario Vargas Llosa has wrestled with the proposition that our hopes and desires may surpass our ability to fulfill them. A number of his most memorable literary characters sense either viscerally or intuitively that Vargas Llosa has spelled out what Vargas Llosa had spelled out in searching essays, that something may be painfully wrong or unfair with a social order they were born into, or that something is not quite right with the way human beings are equipped to handle the challenges of life, that there may be irrational, destructive forces in us or out there which we might not be able to tame. In Vargas Llosa's literary world, unhappiness and suffering are sometimes as pervasive as the two responses with which individuals valiantly strive to prevail over their feelings of malaise, rebellion and fantasy. In the 1960s, when Vargas Llosa was a committed socialist, he was persuaded that human dissatisfaction was directly linked to the shortcomings of political and economic realities that revolutionary action could remedy. Vargas Llosa became a literary sensation for his masterful depiction of the corrosive effects of political corruption on human hopes and aspirations in his first three novels, Time of the Hero, The Green House, and Conversation in the Cathedral. In the 1980s, Vargas Llosa abandoned his socialist convictions and became an outspoken advocate of free market democracy. He no longer argued that violence was a legitimate means to achieve the kind of political change that would eliminate the fundamental causes of human discontent. In fact, he began to make the case that the sources of political violence and instability could be traced directly to the same illusion he once held, that social utopias are possible. In this period, his novels were concerned with the fragility of societies assailed by fanatics, political opportunists, or well-intentioned idealists for whom violence is the most attractive means to make the world a better place. His masterpiece of this period, The War of the End of the World, explores the propensity of humanity to idealize violence, either with the visions of the idealists, the intimations of apocalyptic religious leaders, the patriotic fervor of military professionals, or the abstractions of intellectuals who fail to comprehend war for what it is, the most devastating collective experience of all. At the time, he remained optimistic, all the same, that our propensities to unrest and instability could be effectively diffused. he speculated that the literary imagination could mingle elements from the realities of our imperfect lives with our most irrational drives to give us the illusion of a fulfillment we could never achieve in the real world. Since his defeat in the Peruvian presidential elections of 1990, a less optimistic vision has informed Vargas Llosa's writings, fictional and non-fictional alike. A growing sense that all struggles to prevail over our intractable feelings of discomfort may be doomed to failure. Vargas Llosa's pessimism in our abilities to overcome our demons has given rise to a more conciliatory, understanding attitude towards those against whom he had quarreled in his most polemic writings of the past. The major works of this period include The Feast of the Goat, the first novel about a Latin American dictator, which explores the process whereby a corrupt strongman must undermine the dignity and self-worth of his closest collaborators and associates to remain in power. The novel's protagonist, Urania Cabral, is the daughter of a politician, a senator who had worked closely with a dictator and who was a hesitant but willing accomplice to the most traumatic experiences in his daughter's life. In Vargas Llosa's narratives, in his latest novel, The Way to Paradise, Vargas Llosa recreates the lives of the French activist Flora Tristán and their grandson, the painter Paul Gauguin. Now, he neatly alternates between the lives of these two characters. And in his narrative world, there are interesting antecedents to Flora Tristán's political fervor in this novel, in characters steadfastly committed to utopian ideals. There are also antecedents to its portrayal of Paul Gauguin in this novel, in characters determined to trade one sort of existence for another. But Vargas Llosa used to treat his fanatics and eccentrics at a remove, with distance and reserve, sometimes with a measure of irony, even contempt. In The Way to Paradise, he presents his fanatical protagonist with more indulgence, greater empathy, and less distance from his own artistic concerns and political experiences. Indeed, it may not be too far-fetched to draw parallels between his fictional account of Flora Tristán's courageous but failed attempt to launch a political movement in the novel and Vargas Llosa's Fish in the Water, the autobiographical account of his unsuccessful effort to establish a stable and lasting political party during his presidential campaign of 1990. So too, his depiction of Gauguin resonates with Vargas Llosa's view that the painstaking achievements that an artist might attain in a canvas or a novel, sometimes as a result of considerable personal sacrifice, are sober reminders of what can never be attained in the realm of real life. The power of Vargas Llosa's fiction lies in his consummate ability to keep us, his readers, both unsettled with the imperfections of our world and riveted by the compensations of the literary imagination. I am delighted to present Mario Vargas Llosa to you.
Good evening. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me first to thank the Lennon Foundation for its kind invitation to come to Santa Fe and address you this evening, and to my friend Efraín Cristal for these very generous things that he has just said about myself. I'm going to to read two fragments of two novels of mine. The first one, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, a novel about soap operas, which were in the 70s enormously popular all over Latin America. This is the beginning of the novel. I was very young and lived with my grandparents in a villa with white walls in the Calle Ocharán in Miraflores. I was studying at the University of San Marcos, law, as I remember, resigned to earning myself a living later on by practicing a liberal profession. Although, deep down, what I really wanted was to become a writer someday. I had a job with a pompous-sounding title, a modest salary, duties as a plagiarist, and flexible working hours. News director of Radio Panamericana. It consisted of cutting out interesting news items that appeared in the daily papers and rewriting them slightly so that they could be read on the air during the newscasts. My editorial staff was limited to Pascual, a youngster who slicked down his hair with quantities of brilliantine and loved catastrophes. There were one-minute news bulletins every hour on the hour, except for those at noon and at 9 p.m., which were 15 minutes long. But we were able to prepare several of the one-minute hourly ones ahead of time so that I was often out of the office for long stretches at a time, drinking coffee in one of the cafes on La Colmena, going to class now and again, or dropping in at the offices of Radio Central, always much livelier than the ones where I worked. The two radio stations belonged to the same owner and were next door to each other on the Calle Belén, just a few steps away from the Plaza San Martín. The two of them bore no resemblance whatsoever to each other. Or rather, like those sisters in tragic drama, one of whom has been born with every possible grace and the other with every possible defect, what was most noticeable was the contrast between them. Radio Panamericana occupied the third floor and the rooftop terrace of a brand new building, and its personnel, its ambitions, and its programs all had about them a certain snobbish, cosmopolitan air, pretensions of being modern, youthful, aristocratic. Although if these jockeys and MCs weren't Argentines, as Pedro Camacho would have put it, they might just as well have been. The station broadcast lots of music, hours and hours of jazz and rock, plus a bit of classical stuff now and again. It was always the first to put the latest hits from New York and Europe on the air in Lima. Yet, at the same time, it did not disdain Latin American music so long as it had a modicum of sophistication. As for Peruvian selections, they were cautiously screened and allowed on the air only if they were valses. There were also programs calculated to appeal to intellectuals among the listening audience, such as Portraits from the Past or Reports from Abroad. And even in frivolous mass entertainment programs, such as the quiz show or the trampoline to fame, there was a noticeable attempt to avoid excessive stupidity or vulgarity. One of the proofs of his cultural preoccupations was its news section, consisting of Pascual and me, working out of a wooden shack on the rooftop terrace, from which we could see garbage dumps and the last remaining colonial windows let in the roofs of Lima. The one access to our hideaway was by way of an elevator whose doors had the disquieting habit of opening before it stopped. Radio Central, by contrast, occupied cramped quarters in an old house with all sorts of odd corners and courtyards, and one needed only to listen to the relaxed, easygoing, slang-ridden voices of its announcers and MCs to recognize its popular, plebeian, frankly parochial appeal. It broadcast very few news reports, and on its frequency, Peruvian music, including popular Andean tunes, held sway, and often Indian singers from the music halls about town participated in these broadcasts, open to the public, which drew vast crowds to the doors of the studio many hours before they went on the air. It also flooded the airwaves with tropical music from Mexico and Argentina, and his programs were simple, unimaginative, attracting a wide audience. Telephone requests, birthday serenades, gossip from the world of entertainment, celluloid and cinema. But its plat de resistance served up repeatedly and in great abundance, and the feature that, according to all the surveys, attracted its vast listenership was the series it sent out over the airwaves. They broadcast at least half a dozen a day, and I greatly enjoyed spying on the casts when they were in front of the microphone. Hungry, shabbily dressed actors and actresses on the decline, whose tender, crystal clear young voices were terribly different from their old-looking faces, their bitter mouths, and their tired eyes. The day television comes to Peru, the only way out for them will be suicide. Genaro Jr. predicted, pointing to them through the big glass panels of the studio, where, as though in an enormous aquarium, you could see them grouped around the microphone, scripts in hand, ready to begin chapter 24 of the Alvear family. And what a disappointment it would have been for those housewives who grew misty-eyed on hearing the voice of Luciano Panda if they could have seen his hunchback body and his squinty eyes. And what a disappointment for those pensioners to whom the musical murmur of Josefina Sanchez brought back memories if they had known that she had a double chin, a mustache, ears that stuck away out, and varicose veins. But the arrival of television in Peru was still a long way off, and for the moment, the modest survival of the fauna of the world of soap operas seemed assured. I had always been curious to know who the writers were who churned out these serials that kept my grandmother entertained in the afternoon. These stories that assailed my eardrums at my Aunt Laura's, my Aunt Olga's, and my Aunt Gabby's, or at my countless girl cousins when I went to visit them. I suspected that the serials were imported, but it surprised me to learn that the Genaros did not buy them in Mexico or in Argentina, but in Cuba. They were produced by CMQ, a sort of radio-television empire ruled over by Goar Mestre, a gentleman with silvery hair whom I had occasionally seen on one of his visits to Lima, walking down the corridors of Radio Panamericana, solicitously escorted by the owners and the object of the reverent gaze of the entire staff. I had heard so much about the Cuban CMQ from announcers, MCs, and technicians at Radio Panamericana, for whom it represented something mythical, what Hollywood represented in those days for filmmakers, that as Javier and I drank coffee in the Branza, we had often spent considerable time fantasizing about that army of polygraphic scriptwriters who, there, in the distant Havana of palm trees, paradisiac beaches, gangsters, and tourists, in the air-conditioned offices of Goar Mestre's Citadel, were doubtless spending 8 hours a day at noiseless typewriters turning out that torrent of adulteries, suicides, passionate love affairs, unexpected encounters, inheritance, devotions, coincidences, and crimes which from that Caribbean island were spreading throughout Latin America, crystallizing the voices of the continents, Luciano Pandas and Josefina Sánchez's, to fill with dreams the afternoons of the grandmothers, aunts, cousins, and pensioners of each country. Genaro Jr. bought, or rather CMQ sold, the serials by weight and by telegram. It was he himself who had told me so one afternoon when, to his great stupefaction, I had asked him if he, his brothers, or his father went over the scripts before putting them on the air. "Would you be capable of reading 70 kilos of paper?" he replied, looking at me with that benign condescension due to the intellectual he considered me to be after he had seen a short story of mine in the Sunday edition of El Comercio. just stop and think how much time it would take. A month? 2 months? Who can spend a couple of months reading the script of a radio serial? We just leave it to chance. And thus, far happily, the Lord of Miracles has protected us. In the best of cases, Genaro Jr. was able to find out beforehand, through agencies or colleagues and friends, how many countries had bought the soap operas CMQ was offering him, and how many listeners had tuned in according to the surveys. In the worst of cases, he made up his mind by taking a look at the titles or simply by tossing a coin. The serials were sold by weight because that was a less tricky formula than going by the number of pages or words, since that was the only thing one could verify precisely. Obviously, if there is not enough time to read them, there is even less time to count all those words, Javier said. He was intrigued by the idea of a novel weighing 78 kilos 30 grams, the price of which, like that of a beef cattle, butter, and eggs, would be determined by a scale. But this system created problems for the Genaros. The texts arrived full of Cuban expressions, which a few short minutes before each broadcast, Luciano and Josefina and their colleagues translated into Peruvian themselves as best they could, that is to say, very badly. Moreover, on the trip from Havana to Lima, in the holds of boats or the cargo bays of planes or at customs, the type reams of paper were sometimes damaged, and entire chapters got lost. Dampness made them illegible. The pages got all mixed up, or rats in the storeroom of Radio Central devoured them. Inasmuch as such disasters were noticed only at the very last moment, as Genaro Sr. was handing around the scripts, crises frequently arose. They were resolved by skipping over the lost chapter without the slightest scruple, or in really serious cases, by having the character played by Luciano Panda or Josefina Sanchez get sick for a day, so that in the following 24 hours, the grams or kilos that were missing could be patched together, rescued, or eliminated without excessive trauma. And since finally the prices that CMQ charged were high, Genaro Jr. was naturally overjoyed when he learned of the existence and prodigious gifts of Pedro Camacho. I remember very well the day he spoke to me of this genius of the airwaves, because that very day at lunchtime, I saw Aunt Julia for the first time. She was my uncle Lucho's sister-in-law and had arrived from Bolivia the night before. She has just been divorced and had come to rest and recover from the breakup of her marriage. She's really come to look for another husband, Aunt Hortensia, the biggest backbiter of all my relatives, had said straight out at a family gathering. I ate lunch every Tuesday with my Uncle Lucho and Aunt Olga, and when I arrived at noon, I found the whole family still in their pyjamas, eating mussels in hot sauce and drinking ice-cold beer to get over a hangover. They had stayed up till dawn gossiping with Aunt Julia and finished off an entire bottle of whiskey between the three of them. They all had headaches. Uncle Lucho was complaining that they had have turned his office upside down by now. My Aunt Olga was saying that it was shameful to stay up so late except on Saturday night, and the recently arrived guest in a bathrobe and barefoot and with curlers in her hair was unpacking a suitcase. It didn't bother her at all to be seen in that get-up in which nobody would mistake her for a beauty queen. So, you are Dorita's son, she said to me, planting a kiss on my cheek. You have just gotten out of high school, haven't you? I hated her instantly. My sly run-ins with the family in those days were all due to the fact that everybody insisted on treating me as though I were still a child rather than a full-grown man of 18. Nothing irritated me as much as being called Marito. I had the impression that this diminutive automatically put me back in short pants. He's already in his first year as a law student at the university and is working as a journalist, my uncle Lucho explained to her, handing me a glass of beer. Well, well, to tell you the truth, you look like a baby in arms, Marito, Aunt Julia said, giving me the coup de grace. During lunch, with that air of affectionate condescension that adults assume when addressing idiots or children, she asked me if I had a sweetheart, if I went to parties, what a sport I went in for, and then, with a spitefulness that might have been either intentional or unintentional, but in any case, cut me to the quick, advised me to let my mustache grow as soon as I had one. They went well with dark hair and would help me make out with girls. He's not thinking about the skirts or about sprees, my uncle Lucho explained to her. He is an intellectual. He has had a short story published in the Sunday edition of El Comercio. Thank you. And now something of a very different mood. A fragment of The Feast of the Goat, a novel about one of the most cruel and brutal dictatorship that Latin America has suffered, that of Generalissimo Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. The third time that Urania insists, he take a mouthful. The invalid opens his mouth. When the nurse returns with the glass of water, Señor Cabral is relaxed and, as if distracted, docilely accepts the mouthfuls of pap his daughter offers him and drinks half a glass of water in little sips. A few drops roll down to his chin. The nurse wipes his face carefully. Good, very good. You ate up your fruit like a good boy, she congratulates him. You are happy with the surprise your daughter gave you, aren't you, Señor Cabral? The invalid does not deign to look at her. Do you remember Trujillo? Urania asks the nurse point blank. The woman stares at her, disconcerted. She is white in the hips, sour looking, with prominent eyes. Her hair, dyed a rusty blonde, is dark at the roots. At last, she responds, how would I remember? I was only 4 or 5 when he was killed. I don't remember anything except what I heard in my house. I know your papa was a very important man in those days. Urania nods. Senator, minister, everything, she murmurs. But in the end, he fell into disgrace. The old man looks at her in alarm. Well, I mean, the nurse is trying to be agreeable. He might have been a dictator and everything else they say about him, but people seemed to live better back then. Everybody had jobs and there wasn't so much crime. Isn't that right, señorita? If my father can understand you, he must be happy to hear you say that. Of course he understands me, says the nurse, who is already at the door. Don't you, Señor Cabral? Your papa and I have long conversations. All right, just call if you need me. She goes out, closing the door. Perhaps it was true that because of the disastrous governments that came afterwards, many Dominicans miss Trujillo now. They have forgotten the abuses, the murders, the corruption, the spying, the isolation, the fear. Horror had become myth. Everybody had jobs, and there wasn't so much crime. There was crime, Papa. She looks into the invalid's eyes, and he begins to blink. Maybe there weren't so many thieves breaking into houses, or so many muggers on the street grabbing wallets, watches, and necklaces. But people were killed and beaten and tortured. People disappeared. Even the people closest to the regime. His son, for instance, the handsome Ramphis, he committed endless abuses. How you trembled at the thought of him noticing me. Her father did not know, because Urania never told him, that she and her classmates at Santo Domingo Academy, and perhaps all the girls of her generation, dreamed about Ramphis, with his thin mustache in the style of a Mexican movie star, his Ray-Ban sunglasses, his well-tailored suits, and the variety of uniforms he wore as head of the Dominican Air Force, his big dark eyes and athletic build, his solid gold watches and ring and his Mercedes-Benzes. He seemed favored by the gods, rich, powerful, good-looking, healthy, strong, happy. You remember it very clearly. When the sisters couldn't see or hear you, you and your classmates showed one another your collections of photographs of Ramphis Trujillo in civilian clothes, in uniform, in a bathing suit, wearing a tie, a sport shirt, a tuxedo, a riding habit, leading the Dominican polo team, or sitting at the controls of his plane. You pretended you had seen him, talked to him at the club, the exhibition, the party, the parade, the charity fair, and when you dared to say it, all of you blushing, nervous, knowing it was a sin in word and thought, and that you would have to confess it to the chaplain, you whispered it to each other how wonderful, how marvelous it would be to be loved, kissed, embraced, caressed by Ramphis Trujillo. You can't imagine how often I dream about him, Papa. Her father does not love. He gives another little start and opens his eyes wide when he hears the name of Trujillo's older son. His favorite, and for that very reason, his greatest disappointment. The father of the new nation would have liked his firstborn. Was he his son, Papa? To have his appetite for power, to be as energetic and as much of an executive as he was. But Ramphis had inherited none of his virtues or defects, except perhaps his frenzied fornicating, his need to take women to bed to convince himself of his own virility. He lacked political ambition, any kind of ambition. He was indolent, prone to depression and neurotic introversion, besieged by complexes, anxieties, and tortuous mood swings when his behavior zigzagged between hysterical outbursts and long periods of ennui that he drowned in drugs and alcohol. Do you know what the chief's biographer say, Papa? That he became like that when he found out his mother wasn't married to Trujillo when he was born. They say he began to suffer from depression when he learned that his real father was Dr. Dominici, or the Cuban Trujillo had killed, Doña Maria Martini's first lover, back when she never dreamed she would be the bountiful first lady and was just another fast-living party girl they called Españolita. You are laughing? I don't believe it. He may be laughing. Or it may merely be his facial muscles relaxing. In any case, this is not the face of someone enjoying himself, but of a person who has just yawned or howled and is left slack-jawed with eyes half-closed, nostrils dilated, gullet wide, revealing a dark, toothless hole. Do you want me to call the nurse? The invalid closes his mouth, puffs out his face, and recovers his attentive, alarmed expression. He remains motionless, shrunken, and waiting. Urania is distracted by the sudden clamor of shrieking parrots that fills the bedroom, then stops as suddenly as it began. The brilliant sun shines on roofs and window panes and begins to heat the room. Do you know something? Despite all the hatred I had and still have for your chief and his family and everything that smells of Trujillo, when I think of Ramphis or read something about him, I can't help feeling sad. I am sorry for the man. He had been a monster like everyone else in that family of monsters. What else could he have been, being his father's son, brought up and educated as he was? What else could the son of Heliogabalus or Caligula or Nero have been? What else could a boy have been who, at the age of 7, was named a colonel in the Dominican army by decree? Did you present him in Congress, or was it Senator Chirino's papa? And promoted at the age of 10 to general in a public ceremony the diplomatic corps was obliged to attend, at which all the top-ranking military paid him homage. Etched in Urania's mind is a photograph in the album that her father kept in an armoire in the living room. Can it still be there? Showing the elegant Senator Agustin Cabral, or were you a minister then, Papa, wearing an impeccable swallowtail coat under a brutal sun, bent in a respectful bow as he greets the boy in the general's uniform who, standing on a small canopied podium, has just reviewed the troops and is accepting congratulations from a line of ministers, legislators, and ambassadors. At the rear of the platform, the smiling faces of the benefactor and the bountiful first lady, his proud mama. What else could he have been but the parasite, drunkard, rapist, good-for-nothing, criminal, mentally unbalanced man he was? My friends and I at Santo Domingo didn't know any of that when we were in love with Ramfis. But you knew, Papa. That's why you were so afraid he would notice me and take a liking to your little girl. That is why you looked the way you did the time he kissed me and paid me a compliment. I didn't understand a thing. The invalid blinks 2 times, 3 times. Because unlike her classmates, whose girlish hearts throb for Ramfis Trujillo and who invent what they have seen with him and said to him, who pretend he has smiled at them and complimented them, it really did happen to Urania. During the inauguration of the outstanding event held to celebrate 25 years of the Trujillo era, the Fair for Peace and Brotherhood in the Free World, which began on December 20, 1955, and would run through 1956, and cost between $25 and $70 million, between a fourth and a half of the national budget. Those images are very vivid to Urania. The excitement and feeling of wonder flowed in the entire country because of that memorable fair. Trujillo was throwing himself a party, and he brought to Santo Domingo, to Ciudad Trujillo, excuse me, Papa, Javier Cugat Orchestra, the chorus line from the Lido in Paris, the American skaters of the Ice Capades, and on the 800,000 square meters of the fairground, he erected 71 buildings, some of marble, alabaster, and onyx, to house the delegations from the 42 countries of the free world that attended, a choice collection of personalities, notably President Juscelino Kubitschek of Brazil and the purple figure of Francis Cardinal Spellman, Archbishop of New York. The crowning events of the commemoration were the promotion of Ramfis to the rank of Lieutenant General for outstanding service to the nation and the enthroning of Her Gracious Majesty Angelita I, Queen of the Fair, who arrived by boat announced by all the sirens in the navy and all the bells in all the churches of the capital, wearing her crown of precious jewels and her delicate gown of tulle and lace created in Rome by the Fontana sisters, two celebrated modists who used 45 meters of Russian ermine to create the costume with a train 3 meters long and a robe that copied the one worn by Elizabeth II of England at her coronation. Among the ladies-in-waiting and the pages wearing an exquisite long dress of organdy and silk gloves and carrying a bouquet of roses, among the other girls and boys who are the cream of the Dominican society, is Urania. She is the youngest attendant in the court of young people who escort Trujillo's daughter under a triumph triumphant son and through the crowd that applauds the poet and chief of staff, Don Joaquin Balaguer, when he sings the praises of Her Majesty Angelita I and places the Dominican people at the feet of her grace and beauty. Feeling very much a young lady, Urania listens to her father in formal attire as he reads a panegyric to the accomplishment of these 25 years, achieved thanks to the tenacity, vision, and patriotism of Trujillo. She is immensely happy. She believes she is the center of attention. Now, in the very center of the fair, they unveil the bronze statue of Trujillo in a morning coat and academic robes, professorial diplomas in his hand. Suddenly, like a gold ribbon around that magical morning, Urania discovers Ramfis Trujillo at her side, looking at her with his silken eyes, wearing his full dress uniform. And who is this pretty young thing? The brand new lieutenant general smiles at her. Urania feels warm, slender fingers lifting her chin. What is your name? Urania Cabral, she stammers, her heart pounding. How pretty you are, and more important, how pretty you are going to be. And Ramfis bends over, and his lips kiss the hand of the girl, who hears the congratulatory clamor of sighs and jokes from the other pages and ladies in waiting of Her Majesty Angelita I. The generalissimo son has walked away. She cannot contain her joy. What will friends say when they find out that Ramfis himself, has called her pretty, touched her cheek, and kissed her hand as if she really were a young lady? How appalled you were when I told you, Papa. How furious you were. It's funny, isn't it? Her father's anger at learning that Ramfis has touched her made Urania suspect for the first time that everything might not have been as perfect in the Dominican Republic as everyone said, especially Senator Cabral. What's the harm in his telling me I am pretty and kissing my hand, Papa? All the harm in the world. And her father raises his voice, frightening her, for he never reprimands her without an admonishing forefinger raised about his head. Never again. Listen carefully, Uranita. If he approaches you, run away. Don't greet him. Don't talk to him. Get away. It's for your own good. But, the girl is utterly bewildered. They have just returned from the fair for peace and brotherhood in the free world. She still has on the exquisite dress of a lady in waiting in the entourage of Her Majesty Angelita I, and her father still wears the tailcoat in which he delivered his speech before Trujillo, President Blackie Trujillo, diplomats, ministers, guests, and the thousands upon thousands of people flooding the flag-draped avenues, streets, and buildings of the fair. Why is he acting like this? Because Ramfis, that boy, that man, is evil. Her father makes an effort not to say everything he would like to. With girls, with little girls, don't repeat this to your friends at the school or to anybody. I am telling you because you are my daughter. It's my obligation. I have to take care of you for your own good, Uranita. Do you understand? Yes, you do. You are so intelligent. Don't let him near you. Don't let him talk to you. If you see him, run over me. If you are with me, he won't do anything to you. You don't understand, Urania. You are as pure as a lily. No weakness in you yet. You tell yourself that your father is jealous. He doesn't want anybody else to kiss you or say you are pretty, only him. Senator Cabral's reaction indicates that by this time, the handsome Ramfis, the romantic Ramfis, has begun to do those nasty things to little girls, big girls, and women that will enhance his reputation. A reputation every Dominican male, high-born or low, aspires to. Great coxman, horny as a goat, tireless fucking machine. You'll start to hear about it soon in the classrooms and courtyards of Santo Domingo, the Academy for Upper-Class Girls, with its Dominican sisters from the United States and Canada, mother uniforms, students who don't look like novices because they dress in pink, blue, and white, and wear thick socks and saddle shoes, which giving them a sporty contemporary air. But not even they are safe when Ramfis goes on his forays, alone or with his cronies, hunting for a sweet piece of ass on the streets, in the parks, clubs, bars, or private houses of his great Dominican fiefdom. How many Dominican women did the good-looking Ramfis seduce, abduct, and rape? He doesn't give native girls Cadillacs or mean coats, the gifts he presents to Hollywood stars after he fucks them or in order to fuck them. Because in contrast to his prodigal father, the elegant Ramfis is, like Doña María, a miser. He fucks Dominican girls free of charge for the honor of their being fucked by the crown prince, the captain of the national invisible polo team, the lieutenant general, the head of the air force. You begin finding out all about in the students' whispered exchanges of gossip, fantasies and exaggerations mixed with realities behind the sisters' back during recreational periods, believing and not believing, attracted and repulsed, until at last the earthquake occurs at a school in Ciudad Trujillo, because this time the victim of his papa's darling boy is one of the most beautiful girls in Dominican society, the daughter of an army colonel. The radiant Rosalia Perdomo, with the long blonde hair, sky blue eyes, translucent skin, who plays the part of the Virgin Mary in Passion Plays, shedding tears like a genuine Mater Dolorosa when her son expires. There are many versions of what happened. Ramfis met her at a party, saw her at the country club, at a festival, looked her way at the hippodromo, and he besieged her, called, wrote, and made a date with her for that Friday afternoon after the practice that Rosalia stayed for because she was on the school volleyball team. Many classmates see her when she leaves. Urania doesn't remember. If she saw her, it's not impossible. And instead of taking the school bus, she gets into Ramfis' car, which is waiting for her a few meters from the door. He isn't alone. Papa's darling boy is never alone. He's always accompanied by two or three friends who celebrate him, adulate him, serve him, and prosper at his expense. Like his brother-in-law, Angelita's husband, Pechito, another good-looking kid, Colonel José Luis León Esteves. Was his younger brother with them? The homely, stupid, unattractive Radames? No doubt. Were they already drunk? Or do they get drunk while they do what they do to the golden snow-white Rosalia Perdomo? Surely they don't wait until the girl begins to bleed. Later, they conduct themselves like gentlemen, but first they rape her. Ramfis, being who he is, must have been the one to deflore the exquisite morsel. Then comes everybody else. Do they go by age or by closeness to the firstborn? Do they gamble on the order? How would they have done it, Papa? And at the height of their fun, the last thing they expect, a hemorrhage. Instead of throwing her in a ditch somewhere in the countryside, which is what they would have done if instead of being a Perdomo, a white, blonde, rich girl from a respected Trujillista family, Rosalia had been a girl with no name and no money, they behave with consideration. They take her to the door of Marion Hospital, where, fortunately or unfortunately for Rosalia, the doctors save her and also spread the story. They say poor Colonel Perdomo never recovers from the shock of knowing that Ramfis Trujillo and his friends happily violated his beloved daughter between lunch and supper, as if they were killing time watching a movie. Her mother, devastated by shame and grief, never goes out again. She isn't even seen at Mass. Is that what you were afraid of, Papa? Urania pursues the invalid's eyes, that Ramfis and his friend would do to me what they did to Rosalia Perdomo? Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Yeah. The Feast of the Goat, you know, is a novel in which the personal and the political seem to be inextricably intertwined, because you focus on the consequences, on the silent consequences, of a dictatorship, of a dictatorial regime, in the personal lives of its victims, years and even decades after the regime ceased to exist. To what extent did your own feelings about Latin American dictators, and not just Trujillo, the dictator of the Dominican Republic, on which the novel is based, to what extent did your general view about dictatorships play a role in the conception of this novel?
Well, yes, I think I wrote The Feast of the Goat not only because of Trujillo, but also because of the dictatorships of my own country that I had experienced in Peru, the Odría dictatorship, for example, and all the various military dictatorships that in those years, the 50s, we had practically all over Latin America. I think all this is in a way, you know, all these experiences are in a way reunited in the novel, The Feast of the Goat. I think the most precise experience that pushed me to write this novel was an staying in the Dominican Republic of 8 months in 1975. Well, Trujillo had been killed many years ago, but still, Trujillo was the main theme of conversations with Dominicans of all classes. He was still looming over the country. Sometimes they spoke of Trujillo still with terror, with panic. In other cases, they told all kind of anecdotes, stories, and I heard so incredible things that I started to investigate a little bit, to read the testimonies, and I became really fascinating, because I think the Trujillo dictatorship was probably the emblematic expression of a phenomenon, of a political phenomenon that, well, almost all Latin America experienced in the 20th century. But Trujillo had all the characteristics of the dictator. He was cruel, he was corrupt, he was ignorant, but he was all this in an extreme form. And he was also an actor. I think this histrionic aspect of the Trujillo dictatorship was the reason why Trujillo was so, let's say, popular all over the world, because the incredible extravaganzas that he performed during his 31 years in power. I think all this became, in a very sinister way, very attractive to write and to think about. I must add something. The novel, I think, is loyal to the basic facts of the dictatorship, but it's not a very accurate historical novel. I have taken many liberties, but without any exaggeration. On the contrary, many things that happened during those years, I was not able to put them in the novel because I think they would have result unbelievable for readers. It's a case in which reality transcends art.
I understand that that recently a film version of The Feast of the Goat has been made.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what is your response to this version of the
Well,
Bible?
I think I can give my opinion in a very impartial way, because I have not participated neither in the writing of the script nor in the realization of the film. I think the film is very accurate to the spirit of the novel. I think the essential elements of the novel are in the film, although the story, of course, has been reduced, compressed, and I am quite happy with the acting. I think Isabella Rossellini is very, very well as Urania Cabral, and also Tomás Milian as Trujillo, very difficult role, but I think he has managed to give this strange personality in which brutality, cruelty are mixed with courteousness, certain elegance, and this histrionic vocation, which was, I think, the major vocation for Trujillo. No?
Now, in the period that you visited the Dominican Republic, there is actually something that I'd like to talk about, a very surprising element of your biography, namely that you yourself were a film director once.
It's something that I have tried to erase of my biography, you know, because the result was such a catastrophe that... So if you cross in your life the film I directed, please don't see it, because the disappointment will be enormous, I warn you.
Yes. Now, in your early novels, there were many references to cinema. I mean, your good friend and distinguished literary critic, José Miguel Oviedo, wrote wonderful essays about your literary techniques as cinematic, you know, and many people, you know, including Carlos Fuentes, has written beautiful essays about how cinematic themes enter into a dialogue with cinematic themes in your novels, in your early novels. Now, what's interesting is that since the 1980s, surreptitiously, the references to film seem to be receding, and references to the visual arts seem to be appearing. I mean, in a novel like in Praise of the Stepmother, you have all these beautiful chapters where you make paintings come alive. In the Notebooks of Don Rigoberto, you seem to focus deeply with the paintings of Egon Schiele. And of course, in your most recent novel, The Way to Paradise, you make a number of paintings by Paul Gauguin come alive. So I wonder if you could tell us something about this special interest that you have in painting as an inspiration for narrative fiction.
Mm-hmm. Each time that I have a dialogue with Efraín Cristal, I'm always afraid, because he knows my work much better than myself, and I feel always in fault, you know. For example, I hadn't noticed at all that the cinema is disappearing as a reference and painting taking his... These critics are tremendous, huh? Well, probably it's true, you know, probably it's true. I still like cinema very much, and I am convinced that the influence of the cinema in... not only in myself, but I would say in the modern novel, is really enormous. Particularly in the organization of time. I think novels now tell stories much more rapidly than in the past because the cinema. Because the cinema has used the readers to this very rapid changes of time in the story, and also in the point of view of the narrator. I think the narrator now is much more. It moves now much more easily than in the past because the education that we have received from the way in which films tell stories. But I have always loved painting. I think after literature, my major enthusiasm in art is probably with painting. And for many years, I had the idea to write using also this artistic way of expression, painting. I didn't want to write about a painter, but put in a novel the process of an artistic creation experienced by a painter. And I think my first attempt to do this was a small erotic story in praise of the stepmother, in which there are paintings which play the role of a character in the novel. It was like an experiment, but after that, I dared to do something much more, let's say, daring, which was to use the case of a painter that I admire very much, Egon Schiele. Not his life, but much more his paintings than his life as integral parts of the story. And I think this is also the case with my last novel, The Way to Paradise, in which, well, Paul Gauguin is an important character, but I would say even more important are the paintings of Gauguin to explain and to understand the story. No? The reason is because I like very, very, very much painting. I am fascinated with the way in which paintings tell always stories. I think a painting is a story also, like a film or a novel, a story that you have, the spectator, has to decipher. Yeah, to reconstruct with his imagination, and so this is what I've been trying to do in the last novels. Hmm?
Now, what's interesting with respect to the last novel is that for many years you have been talking about a novel about, you know, the French political activist Flora Tristan.
Yes.
and for years it seemed like that was going to be the focus of the novel.
Yes.
And when the novel came out, you surprised many of us because that was only half of the novel. Yeah. Gauguin was the other half. When, in the process of creating a novel, did you feel a necessity to include the life of Gauguin as a counterpoint to the life of Flora Tristan in this novel?
That was one of these surprises that I have always had writing a novel. I planned very carefully a story. I worked sometimes long time before writing, investigating, taking notes. And then when I start to write, suddenly all this project, this structure, experiments, radical changes in an unpredictable way. I suppose the reason is deeply buried in the unconscious. I think the unconscious plays a very important role also in the creative process. And this is something that happened to me. It is true, what I wanted to write for many years was a novel inspired in Flora Tristan, a French feminist of the 19th century from Peruvian origin, who was a very, very interesting personality, probably one of the first feminists in the political sense, not only in the intellectual sense, they were other before her, but the first who tried to create a political organization to defend a feminist agenda in the 19th century. I she wrote very, very interesting books about herself, about his fights, about his political campaigns. And but when I started to write a novel, I remembered that in all biographies of Flora Tristán, there was always mentioned his grandson, Paul Gauguin, the painter Paul Gauguin, a painter that I admired very much. And I started to read biographies of Gauguin to see if there were some links between Flora Tristán and him. And I discovered that in spite of the fact that Gauguin never knew her grandmother, were very similar. The character was the obsession, the way in which they face impopularity. They had this vocation to go against the current, to rebel against the established order, the established world. Both were revolutionaries in an anarchistic way, because they were fierce individualists. And because I like so much painting, I had then, only then, when I had already started to write a novel, of make a novel in which two rebels, the grandmother and the grandson, would appear fighting in different levels of experience, she in politics, in social terms, and he in artistic and aesthetic terms, a battle against everything, against the established order, facing all kind of prejudices and attacks and frustrations and defeats without being never totally defeated. I like it very much, the idea of this progression in two different levels of reality, in art and in politics, in social terms and in purely aesthetic terms, a kind of battle that, in spite of the appearances, was in the roots the same battle. A battle for liberation, for transformation, for more freedom and more justice in the world. No? Yeah.
What's interesting is that your answer, for me, resonates with what the French philosopher Jean-François Revel has said about you. Jean-François Revel has called you, you know, one of the most compelling moralists of our time, giving your personal indignation at the causes of human suffering and human injustice. Which, of course, has been a constant in your career, you know, in a career in which your opinions have been heard around the world. So you've always been a moralist. And yet, your political positions have not been constant. You know, I would be very interested to hear about how you became, when you were young, one of the most outspoken intellectuals who supported the Cuban Revolution in the 1960s, and how you then became disenchanted with the whole revolutionary left in Latin America.
Well, you know, when the Cuban Revolution took place in the end of 1958, it represented something that we thought, we believed, was something that we wanted very much to have, a revolution non-dogmatic, realized not with the leadership of the Communist Party, a revolution who was defending pluralism, democracy, coexistence in diversity. I think many, many people were all over the world looking for this kind of revolution, because already, I think, disenchantment with Marxism and with a kind of dictatorial and rigid social structures of Marxism had disappointed many people, among them myself. No? So we thought that the Cuban Revolution was something different, was a revolution for justice, for equality, but at the same time, a revolution that would respect, you know, democracy and freedom. And I think that was the reason why many, many non-communist people like myself were enthusiastic with the Cuban Revolution. For many years, I kept, you know, this conviction that Cuba was something different, that Cuba was not the Soviet Union, was not China, was not the Eastern European socialist countries, but something that would bring freedom, liberty to socialism. But little by little, you know, I discovered that it was an illusion, that it was an illusion, that it was not true, that we wanted this to be true, but in fact, in the mid-60s, I went 5 times to Cuba in the 60s. I think in 65 or 66, for the first time I started to doubt, to asking myself, well, but this is what you think you believe is the Cuban Revolution. Look around. And I remember very well when I discovered the what was called the UMAP, Unidades Movilizables de Apoyo a la Producción. It was a fantastic euphemism. Actually, this was the creation of concentration camps in which they were put all mixed, you know, counter-revolutionaries, homosexuals, and common criminals. I knew many of the young painters, dancers, poets who were sent, who were revolutionaries, who were totally identified with revolution and were sent to these UMAP concentration camps in which, well, horrible things happened. It was the first time in which I became very critical. I didn't spoke openly yet, but it was, I remember, my first deep political crisis with Cuba. And then came the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Warsaw Pact countries, which was supported by Fidel Castro. No? This is the first time that I wrote an article criticizing Cuba, and since then, well, I became critical of Cuba, but I don't think that I renounce the ideals, the political ideals of my youth. This is something that I try to emphasize always. But I discover, as I think many, many writers and militants of my generation, I discovered that it was very naive and totally absurd to think that without democracy, without representative governments, without freedom of the press, without coexistence in the difference of ideas and attitudes and programs, justice would be brought more rapidly and effectively. We had the dissidents of the Soviet Union testimonies were so convincing, so dramatic. So I think the revalorization of democracy as the best way to fight for freedom and equality and against all the abuses and I think was something that happened not only to me, but to many, many, many intellectuals all over the world. Probably in Latin America, this was much more slow for many reasons. But my impression is that we were not wrong. I think when we see what has happened with the Soviet Union, when we see what is happening now in Cuba, a dictatorship that is 48 years long, you know, I think it's impossible not to accept that democracy is the first step that we need in order to bring justice and real freedom to a society. No?
Yeah, we have a couple minutes left. We have a couple of minutes left, so I'd like to ask you one final question. If you could only take one painting, one piece of music, and one work of literature to the proverbial desert island, which would you choose?
Oh my God. Well, a piece of music is, may I choose an opera, for example?
Of course.
Yes, okay. Don Giovanni by Mozart. That's a music. A painting, oh my God, that is so difficult. It would be one Rembrandt's painting. Probably the La Ronda de Noche, Night Watch. The Night Watch. And the most difficult choice is, of course, literature. One book. It should be a very long book.
Well, it could be the complete works of...
What about the La Condition Humaine de Balzac, 100 novels? But it's just one novel, no?
That's right.
So I'll have a lot of reading.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.